SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is pleased to present the Jorge Lazarev Lecture Series on the Origin and Development of Ideas in the Clinical Neurosciences. This course series consists of 7 one-hour lectures with discussion. The speaker will be Jorge Lazarev, Emeritus Professor of Neurosurgery, Department of Neurosurgery, Ronald Reagan, UCLA Medical Center, Los Angeles, California, USA. This is Dr. Lazarev's introductory comments to his lecture series. And we quote, "The most significant number of patients with diseases of the central nervous system live in low and middle-income countries for no other reason than the majority of people are living in low and middle-income countries." I'm going to start over. This is Dr. Lazarev's introductory comments to his lecture series, and we quote, "The most significant number of patients with diseases of the central nervous system live in low and middle-income countries for no other reason than the majority of people are living in low and middle-income countries. Nonetheless, neurosurgeons and neurologists from high-income countries author most research papers on clinical neurosciences. This disparity is prejudicial to the neurosciences as a whole. We designed the course as an introduction to some of the tools that promote the genesis and development of research ideas. This series of lectures are provided free to bring the advances in clinical and basic neuroscience to physicians and patients everywhere. 1 out of every 5 people in the world suffer from a neurologically related disease." Lecture number 7, Analysis of the Effects of the Environment, a Relevant Issue for Clinical Neurosciences Research in Low and Middle Income Countries.
And right. Study, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, perfect. Okay. Yes. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the 7th and the last lecture on the Origin and Development of Ideas in Clinical Neuroscience, presented by Dr. Jorge Lazarev. And for those who missed some of the lectures, then I'm happy to tell you that all the lectures are recorded and going to be published in the SNI Digital at the end of the course. And shall we start now?
Yes, we'll start. So, good evening to all of you. And I know that you are 40-something. We are 40-something. I don't know exactly. But today is the last day. And that doesn't mean that the issue is completely closed. When I was, and you didn't receive a PDF of this particular lecture yet, you will receive it at the end, because until 2 or 3 hours ago, or 1 hour ago, I was changing the content of this, the presentation. I started in one way, continuing the other, try to summarize, but at the same time, try to give you something new, something different. As Sama just mentioned, all the videos will be uploaded. All are absolutely recorded. It's a matter of perfectionism. After finishing, I really want to cut and edit just the beginnings of the little things. The quality of the videos is good because it's recorded in Zoom. I made some mistakes in sound in the beginning because I was standing. Things that I learned for future presentations. Hopefully, we'll have a chance to meet each other if we really can make through a plan to go to Baghdad next year and expand on the concepts we have here. So with all further ado, we go to this lecture. At the end, Dr. Ross, Professor Ross wanted you to stay, and those who are willing to give comment, suggestions or summaries, please, those will be recorded. And of course, no consequence to your certificate or to my appreciation to you. If you are critical or you are very laudatory or whatever, this is the purpose of this forum, no? Open forum, exchange of ideas. And believe me, you think that you learn something from me, but I am learning also from you. So I appreciate your collaboration. We started in the first lecture. We said why we talk about this issue and not about how to clip an aneurysm or how to diagnose or do a neuro exam on a newborn baby. And there is this concept of epistemology is an important branch through which we come to know about the development of human knowledge, means and methods of thinking. And this is in your journal, in Al Abad journal, which is from the University of Baghdad College of Art, and which is a journal available online. You just put Al Abad, Al Adab, and boom, and there you are. And they have the current issue in 2023. So it's not a defunct journal. It's a journal that's been there for many years. And this is what we are trying to do and to make, which is a theory of knowledge, possibilities, and tools, which is a lovely title. I will steal it for next presentation, but I will give Dr. Professor Abbas the due credit for me borrowing. Santiago Ramón y Cajal, which was the first scientist who described the neuron, and he was a physician. And he worked with a microscope, with a staining by Golgi. And he won the Nobel Prize for that and is considered to be the father of neurosciences. But he said something that I teach to the students here and I now add it for you, that to extend our understanding of the neural function, it is essential that we first generate a clear and accurate view of the structure, no? So that the basic plan can be grasped in a blink of an eye. That's what I call about conceptual things, no? Sometimes we lose the forest by focusing too much on the leaves, no? What is that we are doing? What is the purpose of this? How we analyze a phenomenon relevant to the central nervous system. No? So to succeed in research in neuroscience, an absolutely must is a conceptual understanding of the nervous system. You need to understand the nervous system, then you can, and this is the same thing for politics or for psychology or history or anything, right? Politician wants to understand the Middle East politics, he has to understand conceptually, you know, what is Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, how each one plays with each other, have a conceptual understanding. Then they will know more geography or history or details, but a concept. And the same applies to the central nervous system. So, as we said many, many times, a phenomenon is the origin of every one of the concepts in neurosciences. You see something, calls your attention, and that leads you to keep on asking questions. So to illustrate this point, let's follow the evolution of a concept, a very important concept that started with an observation. In 1919, at the end of the First World War, the American Army had an expeditionary force, and one unit was stationed in a city called Trier, which, by the way, is where Karl Marx was born, but that's just a coincidence. Trier is near the border with France, thus was near the actual action, because that was a war that happened most in the trenches between France and Germany. And the commander of the unit, of the sanitary unit of that particular branch of the army that was occupying Trier, decided to do a study to look at the effect that malnutrition, the war, and stress had on the body of the children. No, they were shorter, or they were thinner, or the muscle or the bone, just an anthropometric study. No, let's see how the war affected the body of the children, of the school children. And the teachers said, yes, fine, beautiful. And they brought the kids, to the children, to the unit to be measured. And one of the teachers said to this commander, and he says, but listen, they are doing very poorly at school too. Huh? And this man said, oh, that's an interesting. We have a psychiatrist here in the unit called Smiley Blanton. We'll ask Blanton to study this issue. So Blanton, interesting character later in life, I will not expand on him. He really was curious about that. So he started looking and produced this paper, which is called Mental and Nervous Changes in the Children of the Volksschulen of Trier Caused by Malnutrition. He came to the idea this is caused by malnutrition, not by the war, not by being orphans, some of them orphans because the father went to war and died, not by the stress of the father coming back, the wounded, or the mother dying. No, by malnutrition. And I will not expand on this, but it's an interesting study. Some things that were not perfect, but with whatever tools he had, he is the first person in 1999 to say malnutrition affects the brain. And an affected brain by malnutrition affects your intellectual performance. Now, it's a concept that you see it. Yes, of course. No, before 1999, it wasn't, of course. Nobody thought about that. So through this observation, he came for that, and he published the paper. I have a copy. I mean, I did a photocopy. Found the journal here in the library at UCLA. And that paper was read by a few people, but two individuals who read that paper were Dr. Stoch and Dr. Smith in South Africa, in an hospital where I worked in the 80s, in the Red Cross War Memorial Children's Hospital. And they say, if we observed in animals that the production of neurons is decreased with malnutrition. And this guy, Blanton, said that, and they say more or less like that. And this guy, Blanton, said that affect children. In South Africa, there was a racially unequal society in that time. No, there were the Europeans in one side, the colored, as they called them, or the Africans on the other side. And this portion were the poorer people. So they decide to measure the head circumference of the children, which today is an absolutely stupid idea. Who must, if Smithy and Blanton want to propose this study today, they will be sent back to medical school. But they came with this idea, and they found, I will not go into the details there, just to show you, yes, they actually found that children who did not perform well at school, children who did not, and were malnourished because they came from the poorer part of town, of Cape Town, those were those had slightly smaller head circumference compared to an American standard, a standard from the United States, and a standard from other wealthy people in. Fine, that's continuing. From Smiley-Blanton observation comes Toch and Smitty observation. And then comes a Dr. Brown, a British doctor in Uganda. In that time was not an independent country. And Dr. Brown was a pathologist. And he knew which child was malnourished or not. And because they did autopsy, this is hundreds of autopsies. So he started weighting the brain of those who were malnourished with those children who were well-nourished, and children who died for other reasons, no, not neurological, specifically brain diseases. And they found that, yeah, that was those who were poorly nourished, the brains of those poorly nourished were less heavy than the brain of those who were, and this is in 1966, so 2 or 3 years after Stoch and Smithy, and he quotes Stoch and Smithy in his references. He says, oh, Stoch and Smithy found this, I wanted to continue and see if this is true or not. No? And interesting, you see how the idea was developing, but those individuals were like you, they were trying to find objective anatomical measurements. Blanton didn't have any anatomical measurement. He had what the teachers told him. But then he looked those kids, what they ate every day and all those things. But these two individuals were developing a anatomical head circumference, which was not correct. Brain weight were moving through an anatomical evidence, an anatomical explanation. 20 years before that, the Netherlands were occupied by the Nazi Germans. In 1945, the British and the Americans combined, they decided to launch a parachute attack on Holland, and in order to secure the bridges that will allow the troops, the American and British troops, to go into Germany. The attack failed. Failed completely. Boom. It was a failure. But the population, when they saw the American and the British coming, they start coming out to the streets and they start celebrating and they start waving flags. But then the Germans came back, the Nazis came back, and they punished that population. And they punished that the population by cutting the food ration. People had one loaf of bread and one glass of milk for the whole day. I mean, it was a disaster. It was really a painful, vengeful, malicious attack on the regular population. Now, some of of those people who suffer from this, they were children, many, of course, no? Young children, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. Some of the women were pregnant, say 7, 8 months in the pregnancy or earlier pregnancy. Okay, that was in 1945. But then the 60s came, somebody from the Netherlands read the papers of Brown and Stoch and Blanton, and they say, well, that's interesting. We have mandatory military service in that time in the Netherlands. Or if it wasn't mandatory, it was close to mandatory military service. Every young adult of 20 years old had to go to the army. So there you have a whole population of young men, in this case, who 20 years ago were subjected to extreme measurements of malnutrition. Of course, not the whole country, not the whole population, but those coming from that region that behaved in such an enthusiastic way that led the Germans to punish them. And sure enough, they actually found, I will not go into the details of the famous Dutch famine study that shows that, yeah, malnutrition affects your brain. Not necessarily that you became mentally impaired, but malnutrition affects your brain. And as you can see, observation from Blanton, curiosity, determination, and the thing starts growing and growing and growing. And by 1960, people start thinking of malnutrition affecting your brain. The Chileans, people from Chile, from South America, they start looking at this issue, and they described a particular type of child, the box child, the child in the box. This is a picture from Bolivia, but that's the idea. I presume that you don't have that in Iraq. We don't see this in the United States. We see it a lot in Latin America. The mother selling goods on the street to the cars, and their child or their children in some cardboard box, right? Put over there to stay while the mother is working because she cannot help. But that child is a child in the box. It doesn't have sufficient motor stimulus. It's not doing what other children, what you did or your siblings do now or your children do now, which is running, jumping, touching, being yelled up and don't do this, don't do that, but being children. And that created a particular psychological condition in which the lack of stimulus impaired the developing of the brain. I will go to the anatomical evidence of that. So slowly we have the two parallels, the two roads, one the road, the observation of a phenomenon because they were interested, and the anatomical evidence, the anatomical explanation. Why are we seeing this? They were explaining. And remember, that's my word of the day for you or this lecture. Explain, explain. They were explaining. And then came the landmark study, which was not an anatomical study, but they quote Blanton, they quote Smith and Stoche as their inspiration. Smith and Stoche mostly. And this is a fantastic study, and anybody interested, write me. I send you on the PDF. It's written in Scientific American, so it's not written with very technical language. So what they did, the two researchers, Brown and Polly, they say, okay, let's figure it out if this is real as people are saying. So they went to a village in a couple of villages in the highlands of Guatemala, and they choose the same family. But one brother or one sibling had a very good breakfast, atole, atole supplement, A-T-O-L-E, right? Atole, perfect breakfast. And the other just had fresco. Fresco is a sugary sushi, like a Coca-Cola or like one of those things, right? But savor like orange, one of those things. And the two siblings, so same family, same parents, same house, same environment, same everything. But one of them had a good breakfast and the other one had a poor breakfast. And they were watching them how they were doing at school. Wonderful. In less than a year, they actually found that the difference was so stunning that they stopped the experiment. They said, we just cannot continue experimenting with this. The kids of the same family, those siblings who received a nutritious breakfast, had a much better outcome and performance at school than those who did not receive the adequate breakfast. But still, this is an evidence that is sort of, yeah, it's the evidence, the school, and that. Show me the evidence. Show me the anatomical explanation, more than the evidence, the explanation. Explain that to me. Yeah, the school, the Highland. No. Show me the actual. And then came those Benitez Briviesca and other researchers in Mexico. And this research was possible. This is a purely anatomical research. It was possible because in Mexico at that time, in the 1990s, I was there until 1993. Basically, anybody who died in the hospital had an autopsy. So, and the director of the hospital where I worked, he said, I have to sign working there. No? That if something happened to me in the hospital, I have an autopsy. Autopsy was a like the last service provided to the patient. And because this is they work in a hospital of the so-called social security system, they knew the economical background of each child, whether they were middle class. They were not from the wealthy. The wealthy families went to Texas. They knew the background, economical background and socioeconomic status of each one of the families. And they did autopsy, and they did study of their brains of those children. What they found is this figure here. The A is a normal dendrite. No, remember, dendrite, one of the branches of the neurons. No, neurons has one axon and has many dendrites, right? The kids of dendrites, the normal people like you, us, and me, and everybody, or most of the people we know, they had multiple buttons, dendritic buttons. You see those black dots around the dendrite. And those buttons are places to connect with other neurons. So the image that we have from the textbooks is that one dendrite connects one with one axon from other neuron, no? Well, no. The dendrites have multiple buttons, like multiple plaques in your room, and those plaques connect. So the more buttons you have, the more connections you can do, right? So the more dendrites you have, the more connections you can do. And why is this important? You are able now, perhaps, at this moment, to listen to what I'm saying, maybe checking your email, and maybe messaging, some answering some of the message, maybe yes, maybe no. Or at the same time, you are able to associate ideas. You are seeing a clinical case. You remember another case. You remember where you read it. You remember what the professor said about that. And you remember what you thought about that. And all those things are valuable in the working of the intelligence. People, children who were malnourished were in the B's usually. Yes, they had dendritic buttons, but not as many as those who had. And there was an anatomical significant difference that I will not go into the details. But what was this thing was actually showing, yes, indeed, what Blanton observed and caught his attention, Stoch and Smith, Brown and others in between, and then Brown and Polit confirm as an anatomical basis, and that this anatomical basis is what propels the paper, propels the idea or the concept to a different level. Think of this. When we were born, we were children, our head circumference was the head circumference of a baby, right? But now, our head circumference is much larger. If we don't get more neurons, if we are born with the same, with the maximum number of neurons that we are going to have, how come our head is larger? Why our brain grows? What is this thing that makes our brain grow? And you see that on the chart on the right side in here. There is an increased, significant increased number of synapses, of connections, of density of synaptogenesis, as says, density of connectivity, density of connections, that while your head is not bigger, that was Stoch and Smithy mistake, your head is denser. The simple analogy, you can have a room with one plaque and one computer, or the same size room with 15 plaques, electrical power plaques, and you have three computers, you have an audio, you have a TV set, you have a lamp, anyway, you have a fan, anything, and the same size of the room. And that is shown in here, that, for example, seeing and hearing, receptive language, higher cognitive function. And the sad news for all of us is that when we turn 15, 16, the thing stopped. That's in part why it's harder to learn an instrument after a certain age, or it's harder to be fantastically perfect at an instrument or a sport or a language after a certain age. I speak English with an accent. You speak English with an accent. But if any Iraqi child or any Argentinian child would have started speaking English, living in England, for example, or in the United States, in England, before the age of 9, then he or she will not have any accent. It's the same, the senses of the connectivity. No? So synaptogenesis is more active postnatally. And this lack of stimulus that the Chilean observed in the children in the box is exactly that, is the lack of synaptogenesis. The more that the free that you live, the freer that you allow a child to be, to touch, to smell, to go, to look at the computer, the iPad, or the TV, or at the soccer game, or even if the child lives in the country away from the internet, doesn't matter. All those synaptogenesis, the understanding of the animal, the horses, the station, the crops, all those things, all those stimulate the growth of the development of the synapses. But if you are like this unfortunate child in here, doesn't matter how much stimulus you have, you don't have the anatomical impetus or the anatomical frame for developing those the connections. And that is a tremendous tragedy. And yes, look at the CT scan over there. It's a malnourished child brain compared to a well-nourished child brain. What is there? Is the difference is the white matter, right? There's less white matter, thus the ventricles expand. And what is white matter? White matter is myelin. And what is myelin? Myelin is fat, right? your myelin, you have more myelin, your brain is denser. What I'm saying, what I told you before, you see the head circumference in both children must be similar, but the density is different. Myelin, you remember that those axons who have thick myelin wrap, they conduct the information faster than the other one, no? Motor axons are usually thicker than some sensory axons, no? So hunger damages the brain. And all this evidence built around anatomical evidence, it has anatomical explanation. So when the psychologists tell you that there is a working memory and proportion of life in childhood poverty, you can explain it. When they do a cross-sectional and longitudinal plots of brain volume as a function of socioeconomic status, and this is a paper from 2008, you can explain it. You can say the myelin, the synaptogenesis, the density of the connections, the dendritic spines. So when you go, and I will encourage you to do it, sometime in life when you talk to a politician or to a public or a policy maker person, you just give them evidence, no? And nothing beats anatomical explanation. That's the best one of all. So from Blanton's paper in a journal that doesn't exist anymore to the most prestigious publication in any science, which is Nature. And Nature in 2015 did a series of articles. This is the article that summarizes the whole. It says, poverty shrinks brain from birth. And if somebody asks you, what do you mean shrinks brain? You say, no, no. We just saw in the slide that the density and the synaptogenesis and the volume of myelin and the density of the dendritic buttons and all those things. So you can explain what poverty shrinks the brain from birth means. So, as I was saying now, if the function of the nervous system is communication, and communication, a student explaining a concept or telling, or an individual telling somebody else was the best way to divert water to water the crop, is communication. If the function of the nervous system is communication, to identify the signals from the environment, analyze them, and respond based on all the anatomical evidence, we can explain that the long-term effect of childhood malnutrition is attention deficit disorder, reduced social skills, decreased IQ score, delayed cognitive development, impaired intersensory integration, and impaired school performance. The number 7 is not directly related. Delayed puberty, yes, because of other nutrients, of the nutrients to other parts of the body. But you see, all the things that are the long-term effect of childhood malnutrition, now, today, after this lecture, you are able to go to the Chamber of Congress of your country and explain, this is what is happening. Because of the synaptogenesis, because of the density of the myelin, because of the density of the buttons, of the dendritic buttons. But malnutrition, unfortunately, is not the only problem. We have in a series of problems, but you as one very well studied that affects your country, affects this country, and affects almost every country in the world, which is lead. Lead, two origins of contamination. The pipes the water less, that the pipes are not properly done, happened here in the United States, right? The pipes, water pipes. And the other one is the lead from the gasoline, from the gas, from the cars. And now many gasolines are unleaded, but that doesn't happen in all the countries. I want to believe that you have the unleaded gasoline. There is unleaded gasoline here. But in countries that I will not mention, just something may have changed and I don't want, but I have seen recently in the past 5 years, countries that didn't give unleaded gasoline. And you see in this thing that the childhood lead exposure affects intelligence and status. Affects intelligence goes down, and because you don't perform well, you don't earn money, and your status goes down. Okay, you are a clinical neuroscientist. You are faced with this problem. And the only two things that you have to remember is what you learn in those 7 days, in those seven set of lectures. Look for the neuron. If the neuron is the issue in here, as we said, and the neuron is the core of the system for any form of communication, and is telling you that the childhood-led exposure affects the communication, affects the education, communication, then you go and say, okay, where is the neuron? What happened to the neuron? How does lead affect the neuron? And sure enough, it does affect the neuron. In Cincinnati, a city here in the northeast of the United States, in the state of Ohio, important city. In Cincinnati, they had a lead poisoning event many years ago, 20 or 30 years ago. And then years after, people gathered some of those children who were exposed to lead contamination. They did some form of functional MRI or HMRIs, and they found that, there were areas of the brain, which are in red there, who had lead number of neurons. There was neuronal death. And then also, this is a selective vulnerability of the developing brain to lead, and what the lead impairs the synaptic transmission, increases the noise of the transmission of information between one neuron and another. It's something that happens maybe, unfortunately, to some of you because of the internet now in this moment when you come out, that you have to come in and out. So you see, taken together, these effects have the effect of diminishing the synaptic signal to noise ratio. The core of this is when clinical neuroscientists face a problem, they focus in only one thing, on the neuron. Then, of course, the glia, the blood flow, but also everything centered on the neuron. And this is a problem, as I said, that affects every country in the world and affects you. There is a paper on Eastern Mediterranean Health in 2012, and it says the prevalence of toxic levels of lead was so and so, people living in suburban areas. This is looking at the Kurdistan region in the population of Duhok Governorate. So you know that those children who were affected to lead in that, in 20 or 30 years from now, they will have less number of neurons. Whether that they will affect their overall performance in life, no, maybe not, but they have less number of neurons. They have an impaired synaptic transmission. Yes, and those things affect. Those things are related one thing, poverty feeds an improved developing of the brain, impaired developing of the brain feeds poverty, and all is a circle that you can understand very well. It's not the only factor, of course. Of course, it's not the only factor. For everything, there are two or three explanations. We discussed that in lecture 4. There are other factors, and those are, but one of those is this. And you, as clinical neuroscientists, as medical students, or as people interested in the brain, can explain this and expand. I'm giving you just the directions of this issue. No? So neuroscience, I don't know why the S is not, is a combination of those two paintings. This is a painting by American painting or British Lucy Mackenzie. And it gives you the idea that the brain is something that you can understand and manage looking at a paper and painting. No? You did the image and the painting on the right is from a Chinese painter, which I bought after it was forbidden in China. His name is Man Zitiao, and in which you have the brain there, the silhouette, the brain of a person, but maybe you don't see very well because the image is slow, but there is an open brain, there is a mass of people storming into the brain, and the mass of people means the environment per se, right? My brain, your brain, my children's brain, your children's brain is exposed. When they were younger, when we were younger, usually developing brain, to synaptic, to noise in the synapses, to decrease number of neurons, to impair a connection with the synapses. And if you think that with the exception, so it's not a surprise, with the exception of sub-Saharan Africa, brain disorders are the leading cause of years lived with disabilities in all the regions of the world. Yeah, in brain disorders, we include the psychiatric problems. But there is an anatomical cause for those. We haven't found them yet, but there is. Anatomical at the level of microanatomy, but there is. We have Parkinson, we have Alzheimer, we have dementia. And for Alzheimer, there are evidence of those plates that are there. But also, part of the years living with disability is associated to poverty, impaired learning, impaired IQ. We have the idea that doing neurosciences or neurosurgery, It is fantastically well done that you put a microscope and you dissect and you save and improve the quality of life of a person by perfectly clipping the aneurysm, removing the AVM, or doing the surgical procedure for removing a tumor. But the other thing can be also factored. You have a child who was exposed to lead. You operate on that child for a posterior fossa tumor, say a cerebellar astrocytoma, and the child is doing well after, doing great. But yeah, but his background condition, the background noise, prevent him or her to really go ahead and do better. You did the tumor. Yes, fantastic. You did the tumor. You removed the tumor. Great surgery. Cell infection. 7 days. Home. Complete resection. Low-grade aspirin. No need for radiation. No need for the chemo. But with the lecture of today, I'm showing you that that patient doesn't come with a brand new brain like when you pull your phone from the box. He already comes with a story of either malnutrition or either stress or any other, or all the things that we try to subject today. And that The crucial message of this is also neuroscience are social sciences. Neurosciences are social sciences. And I gave you clear examples in this lecture. So when you deal and work with your patients who do have a neurological disease that gives you the impression, oh, is a Frederick ataxia. No, this is a vascular hypertension, whatever. No, it's a brain that comes with an anatomical history that affects the outcome of the patient that you treated. And if you start thinking, looking, and pondering of those patients from this perspective, you will find a fantastic area of discovery and of research in neurosciences. So your task after today is recognize that a phenomenon is piquing your curiosity. Maybe you go day by day, as happened to me, what happened to Professor Hoss, happened to Professor Hausmann, doesn't matter. You recognize that a phenomenon is piquing your curiosity. Oh, this is interesting. Why this child, after same surgery as this one advanced in school, and this one is delayed. Or another cause that doesn't have to be malnutrition or poverty. That the cause could be the pressure of the during surgery, or I mean, is it important to keep a regular pressure during a surgical procedure, or how long can you have a carotid clamp? Does it make while you're doing a bypass, or the clamp of the middle cerebral, for how long can you keep it clamped? Is the same outcome in everybody? Then you forward an explanation. And the explanation, you as a student, almost medical or recent graduate, can forward an explanation because you base it on the analysis of the literature. You use the modus ponens and modus tollens that we learn here, or whatever tool you want to use to understand the evidence. Focus your explanation on anatomy and physiology. Do not pay attention to the rest. You see some outcome that is not perfect or is better than other outcome, just find the anatomical explanation for that. There is an anatomical explanation. If not, create it. When thinking about your explanation, remember Popper in lecture 4 of this series. Popper tells you that not all the swans are white. Every theory is valid until proof comes that until something comes that, well, maybe it's valid for this occasion, but it's not valid for other occasion. It's in your lecture number 4, in your PDFs of 4. And remember Quine, also in lecture 4 of this series, in which he says, for every given volume of data, there are two reasonable, equally sustainable explanations to the problem. Imagine academic failure in a region. Why some schools in some area do not do as well as the other schools in other areas? Okay, you may have 1, 2, 3 because of the teachers, because of the building, because of the crops or whatever, and because of some anatomical reason. One, that you focus on anatomy doesn't mean that those who focus on the sociological factors are wrong. You are forming all together, because as Quine says, for everyone, there is one that seems to be opposing, but doesn't have to be opposing. They can be interlinked. No? And then the most important thing is submit your explanation for publication. If Blanton would not have decided to write and send to this unknown journal of hygiene or something like that, we would have lost 10 or 15 years on this very important field. So don't be afraid. If your explanation is sound, send it for the publication. No? So having said that, today was the shortest lecture, and I hope was the most efficient for all of you. I would.
Okay, well, they're thinking about a question. I might give a question or explanation about the explanation in general. I mean, if you can give us examples of what observations or explanation we as a medical student can think about, like just a few examples, it would be great.
Sure. As you said, as a medical, because I was a medical student, we always thought in the beginning, to have an explanation of something, you need, or to formulate a question, you need to be in the laboratory, you need to have read 75 books, and you need to, just one thing that I always find fascinating is outcome. No? Outcome. What's the outcome? In the thing for example, this, I mean, you see the patient who has had a surgical procedure and you associate a clipping of an aneurysm of a middle cerebral artery aneurysm, no? Lateral clipping branches, boom. And you have seen two or three of those patients and then they do fine. And then one patient doesn't do that fine. You see that patient back in clinic with a speech impairment and was the same surgeon, the same professor whom you admire and needs to be admired and respected. But that extra patient that has a bad outcome or not a perfect outcome is considered as that 5% or the 10%, no? Well, okay, then focus on that patient. Try to find out the look at his MRI without offending anybody, no? Without being like a detective trying to finger point. Just look at this MRI. What is the area? What the MRI tells you? Is there more ischemia? Look at this angio. Maybe had a different angiography distribution than the patients who did well. And then you are perhaps creating a simpler one. That angio, I don't know how to read angio as well. Hydrocephalus, right? Big ventricles, shunted, small ventricles, home, right? 2 or 3 months after, both went home. One is doing poorly. I mean, not as well as the other one. Okay, maybe it has to do how big were the ventricle before. Both had hydrocephalus. But maybe that the volume of one was larger than the other one. But then you find out that the volume doesn't have anything to do with that. That is a finding. The volume of the preoperative volume in children, in 40 children operated in Baghdad in certain time, was not a factor in the outcome, the intellectual outcome of the children. That's a finding. No? We don't always have to find the thing. We may observe it's not a factor, and then you explain. Maybe it's not a factor because the pressure is not a factor, and then you just find. So to answer your question, check on the outcome without being intrusive, nothing. Outcome. How compare outcomes. And then when you find 5 or 6 or 7 patients, you will see 1 or 2 are doing differently. And that opens the door. Like PMG, Mr. PMG, that I told in the past conference. Everybody dies of AIDS. Everybody dies of AIDS. Everybody dies of AIDS. Oh, this one didn't die. Wow. What's happened to him? What was him? And that created the whole thing. So outcome on the unusual. And then you start elaborate explanation. And then if you find something interesting that I can help, just write me and I help you develop an explanation entirely on your or whoever merit. No, I am not putting my name in there. I'm not responsible for your explanations. Your explanations are yours.
It's amazing, actually, the relationship between neurosurgery and neuroscience. Like sometimes how the background of the patient affects the outcome of the surgery. And this is the relation between neurosurgery and neuroscience. Amazing. Thank you so much, doctor. If any of the students have any question or suggestion, it's open for you guys. So you can just raise your hands. And if there's any, Dr. Samar, you can give us your opinion or some or a discussion.
Yeah, thank you, Samar. First, thank you, Dr. Lizar, for the full course, not only this lecture. I think it depends on the people. Some will already have some ideas. Some will need to review some of the videos. But I think that it's, as Tama described, it's a thoughtful discussion. It will not be available everywhere. With this simplification in a way, and also going deep into the complexity in another way, I like it, and especially the idea of putting anatomical measurement for things. I think our initial experience was we're including some good ideas, but no good journal accept that, and that one of the factors that okay, we need to prove that through some measurements, and that's I think many papers we already did. Then we understand this huge addition that people want to see evidence. I think one of the ideas that I can suggest to the students is that you should attach to a case or multiple cases according to your opportunity. But once you attach to a patient, once you remember a full patient story, I think you can apply all the 7 lecture on him, and you will generate a lot of ideas. I think one patient with those lectures and with Google search, you will find definitely an idea, because once you follow a patient or you have been exposed to a full case, that's the key. Why this patient is good, why this patient is poor outcome, as Professor Lazar described. And in addition, what are the limitations? I feel this patient didn't accept the surgery because he has thoughts about this and that. Okay, this limitation of surgery, is it available in literature? No, let's make it a publication. Let's think about what's the difference here. Simple things can, as Dr. Lazar described, but I think many in our countries didn't accept, for example, lumbar puncture as a simple procedure. They will never accept. And I found also another group of people from other countries also have the same thing, that there is a lot of explanations. So for example, if you are following the patient and he didn't refuse a procedure, I'm giving here lumbar puncture just an example. So this may be as a point to start. Let's investigate what are the indications. What are the contraindications? How people decide on this? And at the end, you will solve a social-based / medical problem if you find something through the process, or at least you will report the difference in your current, whatever, institute, city, or your observation. You observe some people have this problem, so now it's a good start. I think other than a real case, as Professor Lazarev described through the full course, it's more a game rather than a real solution for people. Once it's based on a real case, things will be more effective and I think more easy for you as a student.
Yeah, thank you, Professor Holz, very, very, very thoughtful.
to the thing, the explanation has to be also sound. In the paper of Professor Hoss that suggested you reading 2 or 3 weeks ago, was Professor Hoss and other authors, that some of them are here, but I don't want to. I mean, the one of the great advantage of the many great advantages of Professor Hoss that he has a name easy to pronounce, and that is helpful for me, so I don't offend people. But the in this paper of what the difficulties and the level of aggression on Iraqi neurosurgeons, he says, well, maybe it's tribal culture. Okay, that's an explanation. He didn't go any further with a sociological study. That is a reasonable explanation. And then who wants to continue? Other thing, you know the word poet, right? A poet. You have Iraqi poets, a poet. Okay, poet, it comes from the Greek word poiesis, which is create. That's why you have organs that are hematopoietics, organs that create blood. A poet is a creator. And what poets do, I mean, when they create, they don't come. And I know because my son and my daughter-in-law, they are poets. And they don't come and they sit down and boom, come with the inspiration for the poem. No, they carry it at a notebook. And I see my son, we are having coffee, and he's in a moment, write something that he saw something there, and then continues talking. And then 3 weeks after, or 4 weeks after, or never, comes something out of that. So if you carry at a notebook, or as I told you once with the phone, respectfully, not showing any face, just the piece of the organ or the tray, covering the name, take a picture that calls your attention, and then 2 or 3 months, I say, I saw three. What was the other one? And that's how you actually do, no? So that's the theatrical point. And one thing, trust yourself, believe me. When I came here to the United States, and I'm talking too much, I also believed, I thought, and maybe it's the same experience with Professor Hoss, but as this is recorded, we will not ask him to answer. You always think that people here are geniuses that walk on water and the clouds, and they know everything. And then after a while, you say, you know, they are not that smart, or they are not smarter than I am. No. When I was practicing neurosurgery, I had many visitors coming usually from China, from Latin America. And I say, just go to the OR, be there. They don't let you scrap if you don't have the license, whatever. Just stand there, and you will see that people here, the big names, they made the same mistakes as your people over there in your country, the big names, no? They come with the same time. Yes, of course, some of them are very, very good, but they don't walk on water. And so don't be diminished. I know that guy speaks English. Oh, no, that guy went to John Hopkins. Who am I to actually tell him? No. If you see something, that is what it is.
I just want to thank Professor Lazarev. I think there are some ideas about how we can continue. There is a research course for us about case reports. I want to modify this course to be like as an application for this one, and then we can meet with you again to show you what we have and to have more advices and examples from you. Maybe this is one of the options that we are thinking of now, and we'll definitely keep you updated. And I'm really thankful for all the time that you put, all the dedication, all the details. As we said before, the modification of lecture to be Middle East friendly, I really appreciate that. I think this is one of a kind course, and we really appreciate every minute or second you spend teaching us. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to help us improve our programming and for our application for CME credit. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions, comments, suggestions, and applications for CME credit to ausman@snidigital.org. This series of lectures is supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, owner of SNI and SNI Digital, and the Waymaster Corporation, producers of The Leading Gen, a television series, Silent Majority Speaks, Role Models, and the Medical News Network. Thank you.